The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
My latest problem is just being dissatisfied with the state of publishing entirely. Like, I know too much. You know, the first book, Boy Erased, it was like, I'm just so happy to have this book published. I felt like I wasn't listened to for years about the subject of conversion therapy. And here we had this opportunity to really make a difference. So I could kind of push all of my anxiety onto you. I have this goal in life to end conversion therapy and to create bands in every state. And that allowed me to kind of step out from the artist role and go into an activist role. And what I didn't understand is when you put forth, you know, fiction that's just meant to be entertaining and instructive, maybe in some ways, but it's a totally different goal, right? It's like, look at me, I'm a writer. Come, everyone, do you like my sentences? And that's such a different goal. Let's save children from being tortured.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. I am your humble host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. New York Times bestselling memoirist turned novelist Garrett Conley spoke with me about going from activist to fictionist, the isolation of being an artist, and his debut novel, All the World Beside. Garrett's the New York Times bestselling author of the memoir Boy Erased, as well as the creator and co-producer of the podcast Unerased, The History of Conversion Therapy in America. His memoir became a major motion picture starring Nicole Kidman, Russell Crowe, and Lucas Hedges, directed by Joel Edgerton. His debut novel is titled All the World Beside and described as an electrifying, deeply moving novel about the love story between two men in Puritan New England. Tess Gunty, National Book Award-winning author of Rabbit Hutch, called the book an accomplishment of breathtaking prose, expert pacing, and extraordinary psychological intelligence. Garth Greenwell wrote, "This novel contains some of the finest writing I've encountered in recent American fiction." Garrett's work has been published by the New York Times, Oxford American Time, and Virginia Quarterly Review, among others. Conley's a graduate of Brooklyn College's MFA program, where he was a Truman Capote Fellow specializing in fiction, and he's an assistant professor of creative writing at Kennesaw State University. In this file, Garrett and I discussed what it was like to work with Radiolab on a podcast, setting out to write The Queer Scarlet Letter, his intense historical research process, how he inhabits his stories, why writers can't skimp on what the audience wants, how to un-TikTokify your brain, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. All right, we are rolling once again, and I am honored today to be joined by an esteemed guest. I've got the New York Times bestselling author, Garrett Conley, is hanging out with us. And I hope that I pronounced it properly, because as you noted, you had to create a key for your pronunciation. Very interesting.
You did. You got it right.
Okay.
On the first try.
Well, you're no stranger to podcasting, of course, but we got you beaming in today. Are you in New York?
I don't even know where I am half the time because I go back and forth between Atlanta and New York. My husband still lives in New York and I teach in Atlanta, so it's really hard to find a tenure track job is what I'll say. So I'm in Atlanta right now.
Yeah, as you had mentioned kind of in the green room, you said something to the effect of that this is kind of like the least favorite part for you of the publication process. So I can't wait to talk about your debut novel, of course. And yeah, tell us a little bit about like what the vibe is right now over there for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to sound like a cliche because every other author that has an interview like this is like, well, you know, I wrote for a long time and it was just me and the computer and now it's me and the world and all of the anxiety that comes with being a person who turned to writing to escape, you know, maybe ridicule or just like go into a little world that they could create. Suddenly that world is being shared with everybody. And, you know, of course, in the world, like global problems, this is a very small problem. But, you know, it does really get to you because I think a part of, for me, being an artist is isolation and a kind of reflectiveness that in pre-publication periods, like, you just can't have, right? I mean, I'm happy to do every podcast that asks me to come on. I'm happy to do all sorts of publication, you know, that needs to accompany the book. But you know, I'm doing that because I want the book to sell well so that then I can go into another period of isolation. You know, it's like you're just like racing to get back to your period of being alone with the work. And I don't think I knew that when I was younger. You know, as an MFA student, I think it's just easy to get caught up in like, oh, if I could just have the problems that my professors have, you know, they would say things like this and I would be like, oh yeah, it's easy for you to complain because you've already got it. Right. And to a certain extent, that is true. But then, you know, we always have the problems we have, right? Like, no matter where we are, we come up with new problems to have. My latest problem is just being dissatisfied with the state of publishing entirely. Like, I know too much. You know, the first book, Boy Erased, it was like, I'm just so happy to have this book published. I felt like I wasn't listened to for years about the subject of conversion therapy. And here we had this opportunity to really make a difference. So I could kind of push all of my anxiety onto you. I have this goal in life to end conversion therapy and to create bands in every state. And that allowed me to kind of step out from the artist role and go into an activist role. And what I didn't understand is when you put forth, you know, fiction that's just meant to be entertaining and instructive, maybe in some ways, but it's a totally different goal, right? It's like, look at me, I'm a writer. Come, everyone, do you like my sentences? And that's such a different goal. Let's save children from being tortured. You know what I mean?
Yeah, really interesting the way you frame it that way, because I hadn't, of course, thought of that transition for you. And yeah, talk a little bit about this path to best-selling memoir. And then, as you mentioned, becoming an activist and a speaker. And yeah. And then, of course, then turning, you know, and moving, I guess, a part of your creative brain towards, as you put it, prose and fiction. But then also, yeah, I want to talk about all the world beside and how you came to the latest, the inspiration behind us. But yeah, take us back a little bit, because as you said, you graduated from Brooklyn College's MFA program. You're a Truman Capote Fellow. You've been an educator, and of course you teach creative writing. So it would seem that as you put it, you wear all these different hats, but at the end of the day, you're, as you said, kind of sitting down and trying to get back to the writing life.
Yeah. I mean, I think I started by caring really, really deeply about fiction and not reading a lot of nonfiction, honestly. We all know that memoir has this kind of sometimes negative view. I mean, people just take a negative view of memoir sometimes because so many celebrities write them. So many of them are poorly written. But then when they're really well written and it's a good story, everyone pays attention. And so I guess I didn't really go into writing memoir. I was really more interested in short stories, and I got my MFA in fiction, but I was actually in a workshop at UNC Wilmington, which I went to for a year. And while I was in Philip Gerard's class, he was asking us what we were going to write about in our nonfiction class. I'd never taken a nonfiction course. And when we went around, I was like panicking because I hadn't come into the class with any sort of subject matter. And what came out of my mouth was, my father's a missionary Baptist preacher. He sent me to conversion therapy. It didn't work. And everyone in the classroom at the time was leaning forward, kind of like, wait, tell me more. What is this conversion therapy you speak of? Because this was in, I guess, 2012, 2013. No states had really passed any bans, I think, outside of Massachusetts or Vermont or something like that. And so the topic of conversion therapy wasn't something that people were really speaking on. And when I answered their questions in the classroom, I saw how interested my, you know, liberal classmates were about something that was very normal for me growing up in Arkansas. I mean, there are patches of Arkansas where people wouldn't have known what conversion therapy was, but certainly none of the patches I grew up in, you know, the farmland where people were very, very conservative. I think they knew, most people would know, like if you said conversion therapy, what it was, or if you explained it, they would think that was normal. So that was when I realized I had a subject that needed to be written about. It really needed to be explored. I dropped everything and worked on Boy Race, and that paid off because we ended up, you know, it turned into a New York Times bestseller. It was adapted into a major motion picture. I was able to work with Radiolab, Jad Abumrad, to do a podcast series called Unerased, The History of Conversion Therapy in America. So there were so many things that stemmed from that decision, and I became an activist during that time because, you know, when I set out to write the book, it was just this family story in many ways. And what happened was the momentum, you know, the emails that we received, there were so many of them from survivors. And we didn't know at the time that there were over 800,000 survivors of conversion therapy in the U.S. alone. But internationally, that number is much higher. And it's a pretty conservative estimate. What we did know is that the emails that I was receiving were heartfelt, they were loving, they were coming from a place of fear, they were everything. And I really dropped everything to work on that for, I guess, until recently, really up until the pandemic. I was traveling to dozens of places a year to talk about conversion therapy. And, you know, now we have this anti-trans backlash in the country that is consuming everything. And but what people don't often realize is that that anti-trans backlash is affecting our understanding of conversion therapy as well, because so many trans kids end up in conversion therapy. It's actually, they're more likely than cis kids to end up in conversion therapy. So the two are not unconnected, you know, but I do feel that lately with my work, I've just had to find space for fiction again because I was becoming unhappy with A, the state of the world, which anyone listening to this knows is not great right now. And then just hearing all these stories over and over again, sort of re-traumatizing myself, I had to get back to fiction. And that's, you know, I took a circuitous route because I still wanted to look at fundamentalism. I mean, I knew what my subjects would be always is like fundamentalism and sexuality. How do those things go together? How are they in conflict? How are they pressurized in certain ways by their meeting? And so I decided to explore, you know, what felt at the time, my husband said, you know, hey, why don't you just write a queer Puritan story? And I said, that's absurd. How in the world would I even start to do that? And wouldn't it just be silly, sort of like an SNL sketch or something? But so was conversion therapy. You know, people loved a conversion therapy too. And so I thought, well, let's see if I can write a truly dramatic story set during this Puritan era with a preacher, a minister at the time, who falls in love with another man. And let's explore other identities within this narrative, proto-identities. You know, we don't have really terms that match to sexualities in the past, but let's try to imagine what it would look like to see these identities in a different period. So, you know, I have characters that are what I think of as non-binary. I have a character that I think is a lesbian, but I don't put any of those words in the book. You know, it was kind of a fun challenge to imagine ways to describe all of these things without ever using any of our shorthand. And part of that was that I got tired of the way that we're packaging identity as a community. I find it to be really reductive, and I think a lot of people do. You know, we use those identities because we need to. We're political entities, but outside of that, in story world, we're just people, right? And so I was interested in exploring that story world of our identities, not the way that we politicize them or use them for cachet. Those were not interesting to me. So yeah, it was a challenge, but I found so much joy in taking my attention from what felt like an impossible surge of bigotry and looking instead into the past and seeing how people might have survived an even worse period and still had joy and still had space for moments of connection and love. And I think I found that, you know, it's kind of strange that we're going back to the Puritan days with my second book, but to me, it feels like a much more hopeful book than Boy Erased, as Boy Erased was really written out of a dark place in me. And it was written as a desire to connect with other people who had gone through something like that. And I didn't know if it would work. You know, it's kind of a gamble, and it did work, but it's a dark document in some ways. I think I tried to make the sentences as beautiful as I could. I tried to inject as much beauty as felt realistic to the time when I was writing it, but you know, I wasn't able to really have joy in that book. And All the World Beside, I think, has moments that bring me true joy, like reading it aloud to people doesn't feel like it's some sort of invasive moment. And yeah, it just feels better. I think fiction gives you that screen for a reason. I think there's a reason why so many people are turning to autofiction instead of memoir right now. I think that might be one of them.
That's really cool to hear you talk about it and the way you frame it. Because yeah, that must have been really hard for you to stand and sit on stage and read that, as you put it, that kind of dark document. But fascinating to hear you explain kind of how things are currently in our society. And as you put it, the way we kind of package identity. Yeah, it has grown kind of exhausting, hasn't it?
I mean, I promise I'm not one of those turning 40 white cis gay men who is going to become reactionary. I look out for that every day. I'm like, okay, am I becoming reactionary? And I don't think that's it. I think there's a much larger fatigue that is causing all of my students who are queer, where we have like a safe space and we talk to each other pretty openly, you know, they're the ones kind of leading the charge of exhaustion here. They're saying, I'm exhausted from packaging my identity. I'm exhausted of, you know, going on TikTok and listing, you know, my ADHD and my whatever, you know, like there's like a million different things you can package around yourself, none of which seem to be class. Or like, we don't care about like first generation college students, stuff like that. We just care about like certain identities. And I think that a lot of my students who come from a lot of different backgrounds are frustrated at the way certain things are paid attention to while others are ignored. And I just thought, I'm going to try to avoid all of that in the past, because I'm just going to assume that these are full human beings who deserve full rights and privileges. And we're going to explore their lives in a different time period so that we can maybe defamiliarize ourselves with the way that we have packaged ourselves these days. And I think it has everything to do with, you know, the specter of capitalism and how we are fighting for an attention economy and all those things that we already know about. But I do Yeah, I mean, I miss some of the countercultural aspects of being gay. So I guess to me, there's nothing more countercultural than a minister falling in love with another man in his small town in like Massachusetts in 1730.
Well, congrats on the initial reception. And of course, it was brilliantly coined the Queer Scarlet Letter. And of course, you've got a Nathaniel Hawthorne quote in the epigraph. Is that what that's called?
Yeah, it is called that.
Yeah.
I always get used. I have to look it up every time.
Right. yeah, but very cool. And congrats. I mean, your peers came out to blurb it and described as a deeply moving novel about the love story between two men in Puritan New England, as you mentioned, set during turbulent historical upheavals, which shaped America's destiny, and following in the tradition of Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter. But the prose is, as some of your peers mentioned, breathtaking. Teth Gunty called it expertly paced and an extraordinary psychological intelligence, and she called it a triumph. I thought it was pretty sweet. And Garth Greenwell said that this novel contains some of the finest writing I've encountered in recent American fiction. And you must feel pretty good about that so far.
I felt good, except I know Garth so well. I'm like, some of. What about the rest of it, Garth?
Okay, well, yeah. Why do we have to qualify this?
No, I get, no, he's so accurate. He actually is. I love him for this. Like, he will be so incredibly accurate in his blurbs and the way that he writes that it's like, some of means something. And I believe that. Like, I think it has some really good writing. I'm not ashamed of any of it, but there are sections, and I know which ones he's talking about, that are way better than others. So I'll take it, you know? I take it. And he probably didn't overthink it like I did. You know how it is. I told you I'm in pre-pub craziness.
Well, we do appreciate you taking the time to hang out with us for a minute. Yeah, congrats on the early reception. Of course, the book will be released wide coming up March 26th of 2024, All the World Beside. This fantastic debut novel. Congrats on the work, of course. You've got some tour dates set out there. We'll connect with you on your home base there. GarrettConley.com, but it is spelled interestingly.
Yeah, it's GarrArd, which is a family name. I'm not really sure why it happened. I've looked into the past. So like, apparently it's a family name. My grandfather on my mother's side was named Gilbert Garrett Caudill, and then he was upset that I wasn't named after him. And of course my mom didn't want to give me like the name Gilbert. So she gave me Garrett, which is maybe the same in some ways. Gilbert could at least be spelled easier. But it was like this county in Kentucky that had that name and that pronunciation.
Interesting. Well, again, congrats on the work. I'd love to talk a little bit about your current process and just kind of that, again, that shift from, of course, writing this very important piece of memoir and then turning to technically historical fiction, because as you said, you had done quite a bit of research and research. You're no stranger to the research process, but talk a little bit about, kind of that shift into then taking that kind of historical piece and crafting it into, this kind of lyrical prose, as it were, and a little bit about just your writing process in general now as it is.
Well, this is my favorite topic. Some authors don't like process questions, but it's my favorite because this novel took me about 8 years to complete, which is a little embarrassing. I hope my next one is not as challenging. But I read so much Jonathan Edwards. And I read so many ministers from that time period that were incredibly well-known, like George Whitefield and these big revivalists. And I read their personal correspondences. I read their sermons. I tried to figure out what the language of the time would have felt like on a formal level. And then I also tried to read between the lines to see how people might have talked in dialogue, which you can sometimes get through journals. Sometimes people will seemingly transcribe how people actually talk during the time because, you know, letters are so formal that you would think that everyone was just so incredibly educated and speaking to each other in this high, refined language. But it turns out that's not true. People pretty much spoke the way we do today. You know, there were certainly contractions and things like that. And so the challenge was to find a way to straddle that formal language that I'd learned about while using certain diction that was clearly to the time, but also making it accessible to a modern audience. And that required a lot of research. And when I say research, I mean, yes, I read tons of texts, but also it was like, you know, the etymological online dictionary, me just going in there and typing in any word that I felt like using to see if it had existed during that time. I think there are maybe 7 or 8 words that are anachronistic that, and by that I mean it could not have existed within that time. And, you know, none of the characters utter anything that's anachronistic, but there are words in the narrative, like the narrator themselves sort of uses a few of those anachronistic words, but those, I tried to keep those at a minimum. My husband, of course, found all of them at the time when I was writing it and told me what was wrong with them. But I was like, no, I'm gonna defend them. And so I did keep a few of them in there. So the style was the big part. I needed to know that I could write it. And then material culture was the second biggest part. I needed to know that I could inhabit those rooms as well as I possibly could and feel confident in it. So what I did was through various architectural books or, you know, surveys of the time period, I was able to collect photos of almost every object that was placed inside of my book, which sounds insane, but I needed to feel like I knew the place. And so, and a lot of this is erased, of course, in later drafts. Like early drafts are probably way too research heavy, way too focused on like getting the china right. But I felt like I needed to do that to prove that I could be a conscientious writer of historical fiction, which I don't necessarily see this as historical fiction, but I'm okay if anyone wants to call it that. But, you know, I wanted to go ahead and get the research down. And so I visited Old Richmond Town on Staten Island when I lived in New York. And then I visited historic Williamsburg when I was passing through. I was driving during COVID and it was like on the way to Atlanta. And so I stopped there for a few days and I was able to sort of touch the walls of places that would have existed during that time period, learn phrases like wattle and daub, which I didn't know before, like the way that you cross hatch certain walls and things like that. And it was just really important for me to know that if my character, Sarah, was leaning on the wall, which no one would during that time, but if she happened to, you know, would there be residue that would come off on her dress sleeve? Those were the details that I really wanted. And so once I was able to do the language and then the material reality, that's when I actually started to really focus on the story. Early drafts of this took away some of the characters. Like, it's that thing that you do as a first-time novelist where you try to make things easier by killing off people. And then I was like, okay, wait, you know, death is not itself dramatic, actually. It's not. Like, it's very normal. We all know that we're going to die. It may be dramatic for some, but not for people who read literary works, I don't think. So for me, killing off some of those characters too early turned out to be a real mistake. So I had to go back and rewrite it and challenge myself to, you know, the real challenge was, how do you write melodrama without seemingly being melodramatic, you know? And it's not that I'm against being melodramatic. I am a gay after all, but you know, I wanted to make sure that it straddled this line of almost going up to being like less tasteful, in the amount that I pushed my characters to conflict and to, just these really dramatic moments. And I pushed myself to do it more and more because I felt like that the Great Awakening, which your listeners might know something about, but I'll just give you a brief explainer. The Great Awakening is, you know, this period in American history, you know, early colonial history, where for various reasons, the Protestants lost their minds and started, you know, crying out in services, being much more emotional. The emphasis shifted to a personal subjective experience of God that was, could be validated by the amount of emotion that you expressed at the time. This is when we got fire and brimstone sermons, which I mentioned Jonathan Edwards earlier. He's one of our pioneers of them. Although he did so many other great sermons aside from Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, which some of y'all might have had to have read when you were younger. And, you know, that's just the period where everyone became very emotional with God and, you know, it was kind of led to what happened to me in Boyer Race. So I was really interested in, like, showing what that looked like on a ground level, you know, like the writhing, the crying out, the religious ecstasy, which is so like sex, you know, in many ways and has been explored in poetry like Carl Phillips and so many great contemporary poets, you know, right now, but also you go all the way back to John Donne, which his most famous poem, I think, in this vein of like sexuality and religion is Batter My Heart, Three-Person God, where he compares himself to a maiden who must be ravished by God in order to be chaste, which I love. It's just one of my favorites. And so I thought, okay, this is inherently a dramatic period. Okay, don't skimp on what the audience wants. And that goes against almost every instinct I was taught as an MFA writer, which is like restrained, careful, perfectly constructed sentences that don't go wild, you know. But I felt like I needed to release something more in this book. So the challenge became, you know, once I got those two bedrocks of the language and the history, the challenge really became, how do I write melodrama in a way that still has so much feeling and beauty? And I'm not sure if I succeeded. I think the passages where Garth says some of the best passages are the ones maybe where I succeeded the most. And it really happens at the end. You know, I am a good critic of my own writing. And I think, you know, I did the best I could, but I think the book really culminates at the end. And I'm hoping that, you know, whatever I write next, I can just start off on that foot. But it took so long to get to that because I had to learn so many new things. Hmm. That being said, still buy the book. It's really great.
Amazing.
This is a podcast for writers, so gotta be honest.
All right. Well, amazing. Of course, we'll link to the book and your home base there. Again, I had mentioned. But yeah, before we wrap with just kind of your final piece of wisdom for your fellow scribes, I want to ask you one fun one. If you could have dinner with any author from any era to your favorite place in the world, be it for drinks, dinner, both, who are we taking and where are we going?
Oh no, mine's going to be so obvious because it's going to be Nathaniel Hawthorne. I've been trying to channel his ghost just by constantly referring to him and maybe it'll happen. But I would like to have dinner with Nathaniel Hawthorne in a cozy little dive bar where I could still hear the conversation. And I would want there to be a crackling fire nearby because it'd be very New England. And maybe some clam chowder on the table. And I would want to talk about how in the hell he wrote The Scarlet Letter. Because I think all of his short stories are absolutely amazing. But I also think his novels exceed him in a lot of ways because he was rather conservative in his lifetime. And I would want to know what brought him to explore Hester Prynne the way that he did with such understanding. You know, as much as I have looked through the letters between Melville and Hawthorne, it seems to me that Melville loved Hawthorne in a way that Hawthorne didn't reciprocate exactly. So I would want to know about that. I would want to know, like, you know, what went on between the two of them. Did he ever feel tempted? You know, so yeah, Hawthorne in a little dive bar with clam chowder and some fire nearby.
And a dram of port.
I know, he probably wouldn't even drink. That would be what would be the dream of Hawthorne.
That's right. But he would drink the chowder.
Yeah, exactly.
Love it. Well, that is fun. And of course, to be a fly on the wall for that one, I will be hovering nearby. But yeah, just kind of like, you know, as an educator, I love talking to educators. I could pick your brain all day, obviously, about the craft. We'll have to have you back and talk more. But for this one, your final just kind of pearl of wisdom on how to persevere.
How to persevere, like in this world right now?
Yeah, how to keep going as a writer who may be thinking about putting down their quill.
Yeah, okay, I've got it. Because I tell this to my students all the time. Now, first of all, you have to know that one size does not fit all. So throw out any advice that doesn't work. That's the first one. The second one is get yourself a rigid schedule that you do not deviate from. I mean, like, if you have to wake up at 4:30 in the morning and then go to work at 7, make it work and sacrifice everything else for it. But while, you know, try it out, see how you like it. And if you decide that you would rather die than continue living like that, then don't be a writer. But if you want to be a writer today and write really beautiful sentences and somehow, you know, un-TikTokify your brain to where you can sit down and do that, you're going to have immense discipline, more discipline than maybe anyone has ever had to have in history. So schedule, and even if that schedule starts really slow, like 1 hour a week, just sit there for 1 hour a week without your internet, without anything on, with no notifications, and force yourself to live with the page. Get comfortable with it, and then move from there. And it's one day at a time. And sometimes it takes 8 years and sometimes it takes a year. And you just have to have the discipline. That's my best advice that I have.
I love it. Live with the page. Sit there, get comfy. I think, is un-TikTokify a neologism that you coined?
I believe so. I mean, I'm sure someone else has done it already.
Okay.
I'm trying to be too much of a curmudgeon. You know, it's just... it is actually affecting my students' brains. And I waited until kind of this long to be super critical of it, because I do think that TikTok could be a short form art form that could be really helpful for humans. But I also don't think it's helping my students write.
Okay. You heard it here first. We have made history today as well. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Really appreciate your words, your wisdom. Best of luck out there on the tour, of course, for all the world beside. And come back again and wrap with us in the future.
Oh, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.